entire conference will
go through today, and it's huge, and it's so important, and it was so massive, and I don't know. I'm hoping some of you had a chance to get it. Maybe not everybody had an opportunity to read it, but oh, remute, Lydia says. But it was just, you know, it was one of those books I spent last week and over the weekend finishing it and reading it, and it grabs your heart. I mean, this is a book of, I had to stop reading it at times because I couldn't, it carried inside of me such a burdening effect that I almost, you know how you can read a book and you get real excited about things? This book to me got me really excited about things, but it also carried with it a little burden. It started burdening me with what next was I to do. So I had to set it down from time to time and just kind of focus on, okay, Mary Jo, what's driving you? What do you see in your life? And I started examining myself. I mean, it was really an incredible process for me to go through this book. I'm not sure everybody's going to have the same process, but for me, it was processing what drove me from day one. What were the little things I did in my life that you know, that I can point out different stages and different events in my life that really showed what I was made of, what my cause was, what was, you know, what really floated my boat, what got me energized and really psyched. And I can think of different things. I won't go through all that, but it started me on a path of starting to take notes about my own life, and that was cool. But this book is... It's a special book to just open people's eyes to a huge movement that's going on worldwide today, and it's called social entrepreneurship. And understand that social entrepreneurship is not something that never existed before the last 20 years. Social entrepreneurship has existed from the starting of mankind. You could probably look at Jesus Christ and call him a social entrepreneur in his own way, because it's about people that are become so convicted, relentless people who solve social problems on a huge scale. And people's spirituality could be used as a social problem on a huge scale. So that's why I think Jesus Christ, and surely he was relentless, right? And so the idea was that we have people all throughout the ages, and you can pinpoint them in history. Some of these people, you can look at Gandhi, you can look at Mother Teresa. It's incredible how you see some of these names, but never before in the history of mankind have we seen the movement reach the level it's reached in the last 20 years. And these social entrepreneurs are not politicians, they're not industrialists. They tend to remain semi-misunderstood or underappreciated. And what they are is they're transformational forces. They transform aspects of this world. They bring new ideas to addressing major problems. So it doesn't necessarily need to be the idea might be already floating out there, but they fine-tune it or tweak it or come to a realization about, you know, effectiveness that's able to transform it into something workable. And it's aimed at addressing major problems. Not the minor problems, but the major problems. Relentless. These people who are social entrepreneurs are relentless in the pursuit of their visions. In fact, they go at a pace that, you know, some of the people in the book are written about. I mean, they didn't get sleep for maybe 5 days straight. These people are just, there's something driving them so deep and so inward that they don't let go of that vision. So they're absolutely relentless. And part of their relentless is the concept that they're totally persistent. They don't take no for an answer. And when you're a social entrepreneur, you're going to go up against a lot of things. And we're going to talk about the resistance that these people come across, because there's a tremendous amount of resistance for what they're trying to accomplish for lots of reasons, mostly special interests. Everybody's in their own niche, and they don't like anyone disrupting the boat. And remember, what is the greatest fear that exists in our world today? It's called the fear of change. And these social entrepreneurs are all about change, all about change. Just as entrepreneurs in business tend to create greatness in the business realm, social entrepreneurs play the same roles, but it's in areas like education, healthcare, environmental protection, disability, poverty, infrastructure, and in many other areas. Areas that impact the existence of the human race and try to empower this world to be a better place. Make this world a better place. Empower people to support making this world a better place. Social entrepreneurs is a growing world phenomenon. What's fueling? Why is social entrepreneurship growing at the pace it's growing today? Well, first of all, the barriers that once impeded them are gone for the most part. When you look down at the breakdown of the wall in Germany, the communist Russia falling apart, you know, all these barriers to authoritative governments, because that's one of the greatest barriers. When you go into a country where you have an authoritarian running it, it's very hard to have a social impact because there's so much control demanded by the central government. Those breaking those down and having more of a democratic or open environment that allows free thought and free thinking and free, you know, activity is what's going to allow the freedom of this kind of thought process to occur. And that we see that happening worldwide. We also see that the communication linkage is huge as well as we look at view the world as one world. The prosperity of the second half of the 20th century, right? We see never has this world been as prosperous as the last half of the 20th century. Today we see people like Bill Gates, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with what Bill Gates is doing right now, but it's fascinating to me that he and Melinda have been going around meeting with the billionaires of this country and inviting people actually outside this country as well. But they're sitting down and meeting with these people in New York City and Los Angeles and these billionaires, because we have plenty of them in this country, and they're saying they're getting them convicted in their hearts that they come to a new passion and reality that give away at least half of your net worth in your lifetime. Really focusing on why are we allowing ourselves to just be aggregating all of this crazy wealth and then dying and letting it go off and never seeing the results of our hard work and hard labor, never seeing making a difference. Why do we have to claim that we're the richest person in the world? Who cares about where you are on the list? It's about what have you done? And so giving away 50% of the net worth of these billionaires. So this is what's going on currently in our country. Because social entrepreneurs need money. I mean, social entrepreneurs aren't wealthy industrialists. They're not politicians who secure funds from all people out in the they're individual human beings who just are relentless and have a passion to solve a problem in a way that's just, you know, not looked at before. So that's another. Prosperity has allowed this to prosper as well, the social entrepreneurship movement. Since 1900, the average longevity has increased as much as 30 years, and that's for industrialized countries. Underdeveloped countries, we may not see that kind of longevity because they have so many health issues and other underlying causes, but they might only be 10 years in the last 100 that they've increased longevity. But this is causing more people to be in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, desirous of leaving a legacy. So there's more demand on people's hearts because they have longer life to do something different, to make a difference. Number four, the women's movement, empowering women who naturally have a greater drive towards social causes. With women getting more power in this world, it has caused, again, a greater emphasis on social causes. And then five is information so readily available. All the world's problems, as you know, anytime anything happens around the world, where is it? It's on the television in your living room. We get to live and breathe and feel everything that's happening all around the world, which is causing people to drive more empathy and more desire in their hearts to truly step up and make a difference. Global inequities that exist become real to us because these hungry kids, I mean, you can remember pictures, Darfur. I don't think anyone's going to forget that picture of that starving child. And I don't think, you know, there's certain pictures that we have in our heads that have come through, you know, reporters all over the world that give us these pictures that just will forever be emblazoned in our brain. And that's what's happening with all this, you know, available communication. Why aren't corporations involved in social entrepreneurship? Well, the biggest problem with corporations is they're bottom line driven. They're monetary driven. So money becomes a huge aspect. They have financial reporting. They're publicly traded. All of these demands on their balance sheet, income statements, all these things are inconsistent because they're more short-term interests, dictated by short-term interests. We can look, for example, I picked out British Petroleum because we're also aware of what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico today. And what's happening in the discovery process, they're finding there was such gross negligence. And they just ramrodded this program through and tried to get it done on a timetable, and it wasn't working, so they just crash-coursed it to get it done. Employees are coming out day in and day out making statements about this in the news and in the you know, they're doing massive investigations on this, and they're finding that all the shortcuts and the corners that were cut by British Petroleum. Well, see, get the idea. Their interest wasn't the environment. If environment was first and foremost in their mind, they would never have taken one shortcut. They would have changed their schedule and their timing of opening that platform. They would have put all the precautions possible in place instead of cutting it short. So that's why corporations don't make sense. They're never going to conquer this because that's not their ilk. It's not what capitalism is made of. Why not the government? Because our federal government and our state governments, they get involved in social issues. But the problem with that is that our governments try to, you know, they try to help everyone. They have this all-inclusive type patterning. So they never tend to put enough money or enough attention to any one thing to really tackle a problem at its core. They're better in Band-Aids, as we've seen over and over and over again. We see governmental institutions, then we get institutionalized people in the government. Who do you find in the federal government? I'm not saying that people don't exist in some places, but the majority of governmental workers, I don't know how many of you worked with them, but when I go to governmental offices or work with a government, I mean, these guys, if I looked at them and said, you've got to work 20 extra hours the next 4 weeks to try to get this, you know, poverty situation worked out, they'll look at you and say, are you crazy? They're 8-to-5ers. They don't have a lot of commitment. They're not driven every day by what their job is. We don't find that typically in governmental institutions. So they're not effective at it. They don't have the passion or the persistence or determination, and they're stifled by the government structure to do what it takes. So truly, this is a civilian network. That's what social entrepreneurship is about. It's about going into the civilian sector and finding those people, driving people to take on changing the world from that civilian sector. Now, Ashoka, is important to understand what Ashoka is for the book, and you'll get it if you read the book. Ashoka, called Innovators for the Public, that's the name of an organization that was set up by a fellow, Bill Drayton, in 1978. And he established Ashoka. And the reason the book, How to Change the World, really spends a lot of time, in fact, the majority of the book is about this entity and what they've done and the people they've connected with and all that kind of stuff and the social entrepreneurship movement, is because this is truly the only organization who over the last 25 years, at the time the book was written, which was 2002, I believe, so over the last, now almost 35 years, has been totally entrenched in serving and promoting social entrepreneurs. So it was a vision Bill Drayton had, setting up this organization based on his experiences in his own life. They give you a story about his life, and he was an incredible guy. I mean, he was changing the world when he was in grade school. In high school, he was heavily involved in political actions and all sorts of things. In college, he was forming huge things across colleges. I mean, the guy was driven from day one. You could see where his heart was about making a difference in this world in a significant way. And every part of his life, he was carrying on projects and taking action to accomplish that. So when he finally got out of the EPA, he spent some time in the EPA, and we'll talk about that briefly later, but he got out of the EPA and he set up Ashoka. And by 2006, 1,820 social entrepreneurs had been supported in 68 countries through his organization. Over 65 million of support. They analyzed strategies. They developed an array of professional services to support social entrepreneurs' efforts. They help do connectiveness. They'll join social and business ventures, create those to create the best maximum possible results in different arenas. And they lend incredible credibility to these social entrepreneurs in all these countries around the world because they bring with them the political strength, giving them political strength to be able to overcome a lot of the barriers that they come up against, because there are a tremendous amount of barriers when you're a social entrepreneur. And that's who Ashoka is. The return on investment never is money for Ashoka. The return on investment is a measurement of advances in education, environmental protection, rural development, poverty alleviation, health care, and delivery thereof, caring for the disabled. These are the areas where they see their return on investment. It's all measured by what differences they make in a society. The name comes from Ashoka. I wanted to give you this information because I thought it was cool. An Indian emperor in the 3rd century BC who unified much of South Asia and pioneered massive innovations in both economic and social welfare. Drayton considered Ashoka to be one of the history's most tolerant, global-minded, and creative leaders ever. In Sanskrit, Ashoka means active absence of sorrow. I love that. I love the word active in that definition. Active absence of sorrow. So it gives you the sense of we don't look at a problem and fall into the depths of what the problem is. Instead, we actively pursue the absence of sorrow, giving us the positive level of making a change in it. So active pursuit of a positive solution. The logo he chose for Ashoka was the oak tree, which is a strong, tough tree with roots that spread everywhere. So you can understand why he chose the oak tree. And he also said that it reminds him of the proverb, from little acorns do great trees grow. So anyway, it's cool. His goal, of course, is with Ashoka was to create a system that would, with high reliability, spot major pattern-changing ideas in first-class entrepreneurs before either were proven, then support them in accomplishing major change to benefit the world. So his was an outreach program. It was going into countries and locating social entrepreneurs, because every country has them. Every place we go, there are people that are desperate to make change and fighting and putting their life behind changes in their society. But without the kind of support and an array of professional help and finances, a lot of times they get snuffed out and stifled. So this is what Ashoka is about. The role of this of the social entrepreneur versus business entrepreneur, we just put some comments in there. We know their movements but not their methods is what it was historical. In other words, historically we knew about Mother Teresa. We studied them, but we need to be studying how the people move the idea. What are the methods and the systems? We were studying their movements but not their methods. And that's what social entrepreneur is now a study of how people move ideas. So it's really systematizing, making a difference. The idea is like a play. You know, you can have a play with a great actor and a great, but you need a great producer behind every play. And that's what social entrepreneurship is to take, we have a play, the world, we have an actor, we have a play about making a difference in the world. We need a good producer to make it happen. So James O'Toole read, I think this is that Leading Change is the Argument for Value-Based Leadership. In his book, he said, a powerful change meets tremendous resistance because that change will challenge a political or business power, prestige, position, and satisfaction with who they are, what they believe, and what they cherish. So we know that there's going to be a tremendous amount of resistance every time because you're going to be trying to affect change. And that means people stuck in the status quo, whether they're political, social, whatever they are, spiritual, whatever their environment is, they're stuck. They don't want change because they already have the power and prestige that they want. They're satisfied with who they are. They would be making the difference themselves. So when this wind of social entrepreneurship comes in their direction, there's going to be a lot of resentment and resistance towards it. So that means that the social entrepreneurs of today must be champions. They must be obsessive people who have the skill, motivation, energy, and stubbornness, persistence, to do whatever it takes, acknowledging resistance will be there. And again, he wrote about a bunch of them. I just wrote a few of them. Roland Hill with the history of the post office. He was the person that first introduced the stamp, the concept of stamp, and how much resistance he had was overwhelming. John Woolman was a Quaker, and he came and fought slavery before Abraham Lincoln. He was going up, traveling all over the United States, fighting people saying, you know what, if we don't believe in it, we can't have it. We can't participate. And he promoted this so widely that it became part of the culture before Abraham Lincoln even came along, and probably was the supportive reason why we have the 16th Amendment today. Jean Monnet was the architect of unifying Europe post-World War II. Great story about that. All these are great stories. We don't have time to go through them all. But he just talked about the concept of the resistance that people found and what it takes to be a champion, to have that kind of undying passion to make something happen. The selection process by Ashoka, I just gave you a little idea in here because he wrote this out in a few chapters of of how Ashoka decides what candidate they're going to be supporting in the field. Does the candidate have a new and potentially pattern-setting idea? In other words, it has to be new. Now, it could be an old idea with a new twist to it, but it has to be new, and it has to have potential to totally change a pattern, to change a pattern of existence in one way, shape, or form, kind of massive level. If the candidate answers yes, if their idea is yes, then the second step is they get a second Ashoka associate unaffiliated with whatever country was involved or where that person is operating today, so that they remove them from the emotion of the issue to be able to look at it totally in an objective way. Then thirdly, after that's done, if they agree yes, then a panel is convened. They do this once a year to interview all the candidates. So this panel of incredible people get to review all the candidates that come and interview them individually. So they get to talk to each and every one of them individually. And then the panel approves a group of candidates then that end up going to the final test, which is the Ashoka's board. And any decision to support a social entrepreneur in his endeavors or her endeavors has to be a unanimous decision by the board of directors. Otherwise, they move forward. And one of the things that he said that, you know, part of the biggest discouragement is they can't support all of them. They come to conclusions where they support as many as they can, but the ones they can't support are always the ones that break their hearts because they see that so many causes out there are so significant today. The selection process, so you went through the selection. The new idea might include considerations. It always lies around how-tos. The how-tos. How to better use local resources to solve problems. How to overcome cultural obstacles. How to get legislation passed, how to finance an organization, how to train others to work, how to motivate clients and staff. All the how-tos are the principles that come up. Now, a lot of you are probably familiar with Muhammad Yunus and the Grameen Bank, where they have the microcredit. He won the Nobel Peace Prize for getting microcredit into many nations around the world and attacking poverty. It was a huge strategy to overcome poverty, huge. And he won the Nobel Prize for Peace Prize, I think, a couple of years back. But the idea with Yunus wasn't the microcredit as a concept had been around for ages. What Yunus did is it wasn't a new idea per se, but his new idea was the way he structured it, challenging banking theory by showing how to systematically extend collateral-free loans on a cost-effective basis to poor villagers at a scale that seized the world's attention. And it actually took almost 10 years to work out all the kinks in the process, but when it effectively worked, it really worked. In fact, the default rate today, I don't remember the statistic on it, it wasn't in the book, but I believe I read somewhere where it's less than 2% default rate or something on these loans. So incredible what a difference that microcredit project. But that's, again, social entrepreneurship at its greatest. Social entrepreneurship requires two levels of creativity, the goal-setting creativity. In other words, what's the visionary? And as we see, I put Sam Castor's name in there because he's a visionary. And he's looking at his goal of creativity. He's setting the creativity limit of the idea of, you know, reaching out and stomping out malnutrition. That's a goal. You're setting the goal. So it's seeing over the horizon to a different pattern in the field, right? Then you have the second level is problem-solving creativity. To get to a new place, thousands of hurdles have to be overcome. And, of course, this one is yet to be worked out with our Give for Real program. Sam's working diligently on aligning himself with Manna Relief with different institutions around the world to help stomp out poverty. That's our whole goal with this whole Give for Real program is how do we stomp out malnutrition? Well, the how-tos, we got 100 how-tos, people, that still need to be answered. A lot of people are coming to me and say, well, Mary Jo, how are they going to do that? And I start giggling. I smile. After reading this book, it's a whole new appreciation. The massive quantities of how-tos. We get so impatient, we want it yesterday. Well, people, Sam has a vision. Manatech and our foodstuffs are one part of the how-tos, but we got 1,000 other how-tos to work out yet that we're in the process of doing. But it's not going to stop them from starting the process. It's like microcredit was out there. We didn't not use it because we hadn't worked out all the how-tos. We fine-tuned it as we went along. That's the same process we'll go through and see that we'll go through with this Give for Real program. The one major entrepreneurial quality Ashoka looks for, are they really possessed by an idea that they're going to devote 10 to 20 years to, if necessary? and it does not cross their minds not to do it. In other words, it's somebody that's so convicted that they can see the next 10 to 20 of their years of their life totally dedicated to this, and it never crosses their mind to ever think of doing something else. I kind of smiled when I thought about that, because when I got involved with Manatech, it was laid on my heart by the Lord, and, you know, I started doing it. And, you know, people look at it and they start going to Max, or they go to other, you know, we see some people leaving Manatech, searching on, and, you know, it never crossed my mind. Not about going and doing another network marketing. It's not pursuing wealth. It's you know, part of being even involved in Manatech is in its own way, in a small way, social entrepreneurship. Small way. It's not the social entrepreneurship that he talks about in his book, because we're touching lives and we're helping with lives, but we're not. It's not that relentless pursuit. A lot of us have other jobs or we're doing other things, you know. But we still, if we had that relentless pursuit with Manatech, oh my gosh, what a difference we could make with that as well. So it's just an intriguing thing. And then you see here, I'm just going to draw this analogy for you, because I'm feeling it as I read the book and as I looked at what was happening in Manatech. We even see, you know, one of the other constraints that we have is we're doing it within a business framework. Does that make sense to some of you? When you take social to entrepreneurship and you're tying it into a business framework, there could be a social business like relationship, but we have a business framework with a multi-level marketing company. So a lot of people out there have that problem with this social entrepreneurship of what we're trying to achieve. They go back and they go, whoa, well, we got to step away from direct selling association maybe and become a direct giving association. And we see Craig Hill and his group, a lot of you are familiar with the Give for Real program and the contracts he's coming up with and all the things he's doing. And that's taking it totally away from the business realm. And I don't know that that's a possibility if you're driving it in Manatech to do that, because Manatech is still a network marketing company. It's in network marketing. It believes in that as a core principle of distribution. So the business part of it needs to stay in place. You don't convert Manatech. You draw in people to pursue a passion in versus converting Manatech. But there's some people out there that are kind of going that direction, so we're watching what transpires with all of that. But the idea is that, you know, all of these become restrictions or constraints on how to accomplish what we're set out to accomplish. The how-tos, are they totally on top of this? So he looks at each entrepreneur and says, social entrepreneur, are you on top of how-tos? Idealists are everywhere, so they're not looking. You know, you can go into any place and you can find people talk about the greatness of what they want to see different in the world, but when you ask them how to, they sit there and they start stumbling. That's what we call idealists. They can pontificate their life to death, but what change are they going to cause? Pontification is not anything when it comes to changing the world. It's just free thought. What we have to do is focus on how to's. How is this going to happen? Truly, social entrepreneurs spend every day of their life questioning how to, what's the next step, how do we accomplish this? And you'll see that with some of the people that I've highlighted. What happens when the social entrepreneur exits them and that as well? And then one of the major characteristics that they use is, do they trust the person? Because they look back and they look at political realm, there is no trust, or very, very little trust. There's so much distrust, and you can just look at our environment today. It's bad, but, it was bad 8 years ago. It was bad 16 years. It's bad because Republicans hate Democrats. The Democrats don't like. I mean, there's just so much. There's just a lot of stuff going on. We just have a lot of. There's a lot of nastiness in politics, and it's distrust. And then there's a lot of stuff that goes out on the internet that's a bunch of lies. And it's amazing to promote positions, the power plays. That's politics. You know, and that's why he stays away from all of that. Because when you have that kind of distrust, this is fascinating to me, because I looked at it and I said, we can get really angry in this country about how ineffective government has been in this country for years. They've been totally ineffective in solving the health care crisis. Our educational system is in shambles. I mean, we have so many social issues that are in shambles because our government has just not touched it. But the political atmosphere is such that it's almost impossible to tackle the issue, because there's so many private interest groups and there's so much stuff going on. There's just a lack of trust. When you work in an environment with no trust, guess what? You create no results. So that's why he looks at these people interviewing these social entrepreneurs and he says, boy, do we need to have trust. in these environments. Otherwise, he just knows it's going to be 10 times as hard to get anything done. So he's not willing to do that unless they find incredible, deep, inner trust of a person to support. Let me go forward. I know we're running out of time. In Search of Social Excellence, you can look at some of the things that he wrote, and that chapter was fascinating. He talked about the changes to put power in the hands of the youth, that young people have to start really understanding that you know, they have to think differently. They have to acquire confidence, adapt to new situations, manage information, and have sensitivity to work in mixed groups. That they can't be so isolated anymore. It's got to start reaching out to cause this and create the social consciousness and the differences and the growth in the society. And getting knowledge to these family members. He wrote out 4 practices of innovative organizations. The institutionalized listening. Wow. Don't we talk about listening skills being one of the greatest drawbacks in our society today? And how do we harp on that network marketing as well? And here it is, practice of innovative organizations, institutionalized listening, so they really hear people. Pay attention to the exceptional. Look for exceptional. You're trying to find exceptional. Design real solutions for real people. Don't you love this language? This is right out of his book. Aren't we talking about real solutions for real people in our Live for Real program with Manatech? Isn't this great? I love that. That chapter, or that section alone in the chapter, you should grab onto and run with. Focus on the human qualities. Focusing on human qualities. This is what are the most dynamic practices that he finds in innovative organizations. So when he looks at an organization, that social entrepreneurship is starting and forming and developing, those are the characteristics and practices they try to implement in each of those organizations. The 6 qualities of an effective social entrepreneur are willingness to self-correct, willingness to share credit, willingness to break free of established structures. In other words, a lot of this is all about thinking outside the box. Social entrepreneurs don't exist inside a box because the box isn't working. So it's got to be outside the box. That's why they're there. How do we get outside the box? Cross-disciplinary boundaries, to intermix different disciplines. Again, work within a mixed group. Don't stay within yourself. Don't stay within your own knowledge. Get cross-knowledge, cross-germination of information. Willingness to work quietly. In other words, a lot of these social entrepreneurs, they start out small. They work in a way, because if they start out working big, then it's all about them. This isn't about them. It's about the movement. It's about making the difference. It's truly about change. And then the strong ethical impetus. Dream not of money, but of a better world. Examples of great social entrepreneurs. He goes through in his book, and I gave you, I don't know how many of these, but you can read these on your own time. We don't have time to go through them all, but each one of these people, there are chapters on each one of these people, and it's so amazing to read about their stories, and it's the stories of what they accomplished, like Gloria D'Souza, 45-year-old school teacher in Bombay who was worn out because the Indian education system was totally structured, reading no creativity, no thinking. It was like by rote. They were taught by rote. She went out and was exposed to experiential and environmental training, and she just it just broke her heart what India was doing to these beautiful young kids. She worked and she put all her guts and energy behind changing the educational system of India, and she did it. I mean, these are the kind of people. Fabio Rosa. This is a 22-year-old kid who was trying to deliver electricity to rural Brazil. Why? Because he saw the transition. Everybody in rural Brazil was moving into the cities. The government was only dealing with symptoms. In other words, they were dealing with building slums to house all these people coming in from rural Brazil because they couldn't afford to live in rural Brazil anymore. Well, why? Instead of attacking the problem, what was the problem? They couldn't live in rural Brazil because they couldn't create an income flow. Why couldn't they create income? Because they couldn't farm. Why couldn't they farm? Because water was too expensive and too scarce. And yet they were living on top of incredible water plateaus. But they couldn't get electricity because electricity was too expensive to be able to tap into the water, so they ended up starving to death or moving into the city. They only had one alternative. Well, this 22-year-old, understand, at 22 years old, went crazy. He said, this is nuts. We can solve this problem. We've got to go back and get people back in their homes so they can live in rural. We've got to make it a feasible living existence and bring new money back. So he came up with a process of being able to string single-level energy instead of dual, you know, electricity, single electricity, And he came in with processes to be able to tap into the water plateau and bring that pipes down and bring wells to all of these so that they could irrigate their lands. Not only could they irrigate their lands with this limited electricity that was very cost effective, but he also introduced a way that they could get rid of some of their problems they had with weeds. And he ended up allowing these people not only to grow and be effective, but grow four times as much on their lands because they could use all their land instead of only 25% of their land. And he took this and he ran with it, and unbelievable the results he created in rural Brazil, attacking the problem in a new way, turning the crystal, looking at it new. Florence Nightingale, we know about her nursing. Brayton, I'm sorry, I spelled his name wrong there in the outline. Brayton himself totally revamped the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, to create greater, quicker change in pollution emission control over U.S. industry. Giroux Billimoria, she was a woman who founded Childline, a 24-hour helpline emergency response system for children. It grew to be huge, 42 cities by the time this book was written. And she's doing she did a huge initiative with the government of India on national child protection. I mean, these are all, I won't go through all the rest of them, but you can read them. They're just amazing stories, and there are entire chapters on each one of these people in the book that just really just touch your heart in a significant way. And in the conclusion part of the book, he just talks about social entrepreneurship, creative, tenacious individuals with unshakable motivation. They're needed to propel the innovation that is necessary for society to tackle its most serious ills. A citizen sector, and that's what we're talking about, not the political sector, not the industrial sector, a citizen sector is absolutely crucial in order to tackle world problems because they need to have that singular focus, unlike government that has such a multitude of focus it's impossible to do anything very well, the tenacity to get it done at whatever cost. And these motivations aren't found in government. And there are issues that are generally never the focus of the business sector. So again, the citizen sector is crucial for the future of the world. Things that Goethe quoted in his book, he said, things that matter most must never be at the mercy of things that matter least. And then I put, at the end, I just put his closing comment in the epilogue because I thought it was so cool. He just, if I have learned one thing from writing this book, it is that people who can solve problems must somehow first arrive at the belief they can solve problems. This belief does not emerge suddenly. The capacity to cause change grows in an individual over time as small-scale efforts lead gradually to larger ones. But the process needs a beginning, a story, an example, an early taste of success. Something along the way that helps a person form the belief that it is possible to make the world a better place. Those who act on that belief spread it to others. They are highly contagious, and their stories must be told. And that's the book, people. It was absolutely a delight to read. It just will touch your heart in incredible ways, open your eyes to social entrepreneurship in a way that I surely wasn't familiar with until I read the book. I obviously had some familiarity with a lot of these people that he mentioned in the book, but understanding it as a movement, as what it is, it put me into serious, internal investigation of my own. But the other thing it did, I came to the conclusion, I said, I'm going to go, when I go to Manatech this week, I'm going to go and visit Sam, and I'm going to tell Sam that I think not to get David Bornstein, but I think what we ought to do is we ought to try to get this Bill Drayton. He's the guy who started Ashoka and formed it. I would love to get him to come to Manifest and to hear from a person of that nature. I think that would be so awesome for our Manifest as a special guest. I just think it would just leave everybody with this incredible heart and passion and touch us. Because I think we all have that passion inside us. I just think that sometimes we quash it because we don't believe we can make a difference. And that's where we need to start, is making that little, like he says at the end of the book, we just need to make a little change and be a part of a little change and read people's stories, and that's what opens our hearts and minds to the greatness of what we really can create if we put our energy and passion behind it at its fullest level. So, anyway, any feedback? We're done for the call today, people. Anyone have any feedback or comments? Anyone else might have read the book, or you have any comments about what you heard today? quiet group. I definitely can see how this book could shake somebody's conscience, though. I can
tell.
Yeah.
Rachel, I did have a comment, and I'm just, you know, just all thinking. This is Anne. It seems to me that, you know, that the network marketing, scenario, the win-win scenario, actually, of all the business models, might be the most conducive to this.
Right. I agree. In fact, I see a lot of correlation to it throughout the book. Yeah.
Right. So, I just to sum up, you know, I don't think we have to leave. I think we can work with that very well.
Oh, I think so, too. I think the two can conjoin, but I don't think you can make it exclusively one or the other. Does that make sense?
Exactly.
I think a network marketing company can truly take on a social consciousness of its own, and I think Manatech's about to go through that transition. But I also don't think it can exclusively set aside the business side of what network marketing is either. I think there has to be a marriage. Yeah, a problem. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Wonderful review.
Uh-huh.
Mary Jo?
Uh-huh.
Mary Jo, I was wondering how to implement a plan like this with people that are struggling themselves, because their focus is just on getting food on the table, making sure they have a roof over their head.
Well,
how can they be incorporated in this?
It's a great question, and it's the how-tos that cause us to struggle and come to the solutions. Is that, you know, in so many times we look at people who are starving or people who don't have enough, and we go, you know, they just don't. I hear it throughout Manatech all the time. Well, people just don't have enough money, and I go, where's our creativity? Where's our creative side that's going to sit down and say, wait a minute, there are a million, there's an infinite amount of mechanisms as long as somebody puts their belief behind something. It's very much like the Clemmer, and I don't mean to overemphasize that, but the concept of the intent plus mechanism equals result. Intent and the belief is there and the commitment is there. There are endless mechanisms. We get too caught up in mechanism. What we need to do is say, okay, I believe this can happen, and then start, okay, if I believe it's going to happen, if I totally commit to it happening, then how is it going to happen? You just start moving in that direction, and you watch the universe, and you watch the people around you, because you're going to take, if I said to you, I'm totally committed to uplifting this area of Fort Worth and making it and raising the economic level of this area of Fort Worth, I'm totally committed. If I made that total commitment, I'm going to tell you, I don't have to know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to start working 24/7 around the clock to find the right people, get people around me, look at ideas, look at what's done in the past, and then fine-tune and come up with, you know, creative ways of creating something different, because there are always creative ways. Does that make some sense? And we get stuck sometimes with thinking, because when you look at this Fabio guy from Brazil, with everybody moving out of rural Brazil and saying, hey, you know, we can't survive anymore, everybody go, oh my gosh, this is a movement towards, you know, everybody moving into the cities. We're going to have mass population in the cities, no one out in the rurals, and everybody goes, well, because it's impossible to make income up there. Well, Fabio didn't say it's impossible. He said it's impossible the way it is now, but clearly there has to be a way to make it different. And when you dedicate and put your passion behind it and be fully committed, the how-tos, you'll start going, okay, how to do this, how to do this, how do I find, well, if I don't know how to do it, then I start asking people. And you start going out and you start getting a consensus and you start getting a group of people together and saying how to do this. And, you know, some of the best people to determine how to do it, the people in the mix that are there sitting there. If I work with somebody that says, I don't have the money to do this marriage, I said, well, let's sit down and figure out how to do this. How could we do this? What are you spending your money on now? What are you doing now? What can you do differently? Can we do different fundraisers? Can you get a group of people over at your house so that we can sign up 6 of them that have the capacity, and then by that way we can buy your all-star pack, huh? I mean, there are just a zillion how-tos out there. It's just putting the brain power behind it and just working on it to make it happen. Does that help? I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I'm rambling and saying I just believe anything's possible.
I guess I'm asking is, bringing that possibility to people who are in survival mode.
Are there people that are sitting on this planet today who are just in total scarcity survival mode, and they don't even have the capacity to believe? Is that what you're saying?
Well, everybody has the capacity. But when it looks so dark, it's like somebody is just trying to get food on the table and looking at the social entrepreneurship, it's kind of like, listen, my main focus is just that my kids get fed. So it's breaking through that I don't know, the closed offness, I don't know how to even explain it, that they're just so caught up in that. I'm looking for a way of kind of, I don't know, opening up a hand and saying, hey, when you join this, you're coming out of that darkness.
Right. I mean, you want them to get into social entrepreneurship, but their first step is get you out of the darkness you're in. Just like the first step to getting farmers successful was making sure that they had water to get them successful. In order to get the water, they needed to have electricity to pump the water out of the plateau underlying their lands. In order to get electricity, they just kept backing it up. But you have to go to the core problem. The core problem for these people is they right now they don't have an income source. So how do I set up that? How do I solve that core problem? Well, your core problem is you don't have an income source. Manitech's going to give it to you, but you got to. How do you start with Manitech when you don't even have a dime to buy the Manitech pack? So let's get creative. What other resources do you have? How many family members do you have? Do you have a community of interest? Do you have people in your church that might be interested in joining on the Give for Real program? You could become the big social entrepreneur in your church towards raising awareness, social consciousness about malnutrition, and this is a mechanism that you're using to achieve that. And you, because these people, they may not have money today, but they have time, they have energy, so it's just got to get drive a belief system in them. That's what social entrepreneurship is all about, people who don't have resources, which is why Ashoka was established, because they wanted to go out and find these social entrepreneurs who have no money, have no resources, and be able to support them to accomplish the dreams that they have. And it's not just a dream, but it's a passion. You know, it's more than just a dream. It's something that's, driving them. So come up with other suggestions. And I mean, I think you could take this Give for Real program and walk into a church and meet with a pastor or meet with somebody in church and say, listen, here's a cool program that I'd love our church to get involved in. Why can't they do that? Take you along. You're the one that's the forebearer of the truth and understand it inside and out, upside and down, and you could be the one that supports them doing that. Or take it to the Rotary Club, or take it to another. There's tons of organizations out there that are looking for good places to contribute or where they could make a difference, how they could do a fundraiser to make a difference. I mean, they're just, again, the ideas are endless. It's just about trying to figure out how to do it. I look at this gentleman at Craig Hill's, associated with Craig Hill out in Colorado. He signed up 380 people last year with All-Star Packs or some. He hit the all-time record in All-Star Packs in 1 year. I think he was the number one enroller in the United States, right? And how did he do it? He talked about, I think it was in Guatemala. It wasn't in Mexico. I believe it was in Guatemala, where he was in the mission field in Guatemala, and these kids are starving, and they had no nutrition. So he had an idea. He says, buy an All-Star pack, and you keep half of it, and the other half gets shipped to Guatemala. This is how we're going to support people, and this is the structure we're going to put it in so everybody can continue to support these people by building this organization that helps support these kids. And he got 370 people to buy All-Star packs. Now, that's a creative way of doing it. If you're a little person who can't afford an All-Star pack can find six people that can afford it, then guess what? They can afford it because they'll get $1,000. They'll make their Fast Start bonus and their Power bonus by getting those six people signed up. There's a way to get involved in Manitech. I mean, there are too many ways out there that we just need to get creative. But if you stay stuck in living in a survival mode, you've got to the first step, I believe, is to really totally take on, I'm not going to stay in survival mode no matter what. You've got to believe that this is not where you are. This is temporary. People take on poor as permanent. I think you take on, right now I don't have the income, as a temporary situation, and you believe that life is going to be 10 times better in a year from now. And then you start doing something about it. But the belief system has to be worked on. Huge. It's got to be there.
Mary Jo, I got a question along this line, okay?
Yep.
Okay. Do you, for the U.S. children, are they going to be eligible for this Give for Real program, and do they have
Absolutely.
To be an orphan?
No. Sam is working with all sorts of organizations in poverty zones throughout cities around the country to help support our destitute kids, because we've got plenty malnourished kids in this country. He's also working with people with school lunch programs, things like that. I mean, this is big. This is not... See, Fred, great question, but these are the how-tos, right? These are the how are we actually going to do it, and these are all being... Sam's taking on a huge role with that, as well as Linda. And all of Manna Relief is dedicated to that. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's a huge... It's not just as easy as the Give for Real is great. We heard Sam, and that's great. But I just, after reading this book, I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, what's going on behind the scenes has to be 10 times larger than what's going on in front of us that we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's big. It's big.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
Mary Jo, this is Joni. Did you send out the Craig Hill program like you talked about last week?
I didn't send it out because I received it and I wasn't happy with it.
Oh,
does that
okay.
make sense to you? I just, I wasn't happy with it. So it's nothing against Craig. I have some misgivings about it, and I just didn't feel appropriate that I was going to be the one to share it. I mean, I know other organizations have sent it out and passed it around, but I think we need to see it in a better format than what it was. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Right. Is there any way that I personally can get that to look at?
Yeah.
It?
Just send me an email.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Okay, everybody. Love you all. Have a great week. Let's go out there. I know. I just like go to, and I don't, you know, I want you to feel empowered by all of this. I don't want you to get into what can I do, a lowly as me, I don't have anything. I want you to go, my gosh, well, you know, I really think that you can start digging into seeing what events in your life, where in your life, this is the pattern I went through. I went back and I started looking every day, you know, when I was a little kid, what impacted me? What were the little things that really totally impacted me in changing the world, and things that I wanted to see different, you know, and you know, all the different events that I could see where I played a role. And I started writing these down, and I mean, I thought of things I never would have thought out. I mean, I had totally forgotten it had happened in my life when I was reading through this book. It just triggered a real sensitivity to some of those, and it was really a pretty amazing process. So you know, we all have that drive in us and a passion in there somewhere. It's just how have we quashed it, and you know, how can we make it alive again? And it's not that you have to, you know, these social entrepreneurs aren't every one of us. We can be a social entrepreneur in our own way. You know, we may not be Florence Nightingale or, you know, I mean, these are people that are just, you know, there are only so many Mother Teresa's or Gandhi's or Florence Nightingale's in the world that do these kind of things. But we have in our own way the ability to be a social entrepreneur. And that's what we need to look at and understand and see how we can affect a change. And Manatech is a way that we can do that. I think Sam has given us all a position to be a part of this process, and to contribute in a significant way on this malnutrition issue, which is, for me, huge as well. When you know 5 million children die every year from malnutrition, and I look back at myself and I go, so what have I been doing about it for the last 20 years? Nothing, right? Okay, so what am I going to do about it going forward? Something, right? Okay. All right, you guys. Love you all. Oh, by the way, one more thing. Oh, no call next Monday, but we'll send an email on that because it's July 5th. Okay? Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.